TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. American Nuremberg. The U.S. officials who should stand trial for post-9/11 war crimes. An interview with Rebecca Gordon. To this day, the people of the United States have no accounting of what has been done in our names in the so-called War on Terror. But we are left with ongoing misery for literally millions of people, destabilized regions in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, North Africa, and blowback and spillover into Europe. And it is extraordinary how a small group of political leaders could have created such ongoing expanding devastation and has not been held responsible in any way. Rebecca Gordon writes that for the sake of the victims of the war on terror, we need real accountability for American war criminals. Her book, American Nuremberg, published by Hot Books at Skyhorse, New York City, went into distribution in April 2016. If you are a longtime listener to TUC Radio, you occasionally hear rebroadcasts of programs produced by my colleague, Jeffrey Blankford. He's a well-known photographer, longtime activist, and host of a radio program on foreign policy, Takes on the World. In June 2016, he interviewed our mutual friend, Rebecca Gordon, on KZYX Radio in Philo, California. This is Jeff Blankford.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Rebecca Gordon once again to Takes on the World.
Jeffrey, it's a joy to be with you.
Your book really, really impressed me and was so timely. And it begins with an eloquent moving forward of how you came to write American Nuremberg. And I'd like you to share some of that with our listeners.
I was just hanging out in my usual life, teaching ethics to young people, when I got an email last March from David Talbot, who is the author, many people probably know him best as the author of Season of the Witch. So this is a well-known book. So David Talbot is also one of the original founders of Salon.com. So I had certainly heard of him, and this email arrived in my mailbox saying, I want you to write a book, and here's the title, American Nuremberg. And I was thrilled to have somebody actually ask me to write a book, but I was not happy with the title. And the reason why is that I'm a child of the 1950s. My parents lived through World War II. My father was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home in Norfolk, Virginia. And I grew up understanding that really, if there was one symbol of the depth of evil to which human beings could fall, it was the barbarism that enveloped Europe, that supposedly civilized continent, in the mid-20th century that began with the Nazis. That was the Nazi rise to power, the Holocaust. At the end of World War II, somewhere between 65 and 80 million people around the world had died. And so, terrible as I think the crimes that my country has committed in this so-called war on terror, they are nothing on the same scale as the crimes that people were put on trial for at Nuremberg. And so for people who might not remember, Nuremberg is the name of a city in Germany, and it's the place where the four victors in World War II, that would be Great Britain, France, the United States, and the Soviet Union, came together to put on trial a number up to, in the end, 200 high officials in the German Nazi government and some of the people in civilian life who had assisted them. But the most famous trials were the first ones, in which 22 people were put on trial. 19 of them were convicted. 3 of them were acquitted. And this is what we mean when we say Nuremberg. And it was the first time something really important historically happened at Nuremberg. It was really the first time in human history that internationally the nations of the world came together and said the actions of the people leading this particular nation have violated the laws and customs of war. They are wrong. And rather than simply taking what was called victor's justice, in other words, just lining up against a wall and shooting them, they said, we are going to actually put together a tribunal. We're going to put together a trial. We're going to have rules. We're going to have specific crimes that people are being tried for. They're going to have defense attorneys. We're going to have prosecutors. And we are going to put the international mark on justice and say international law is real law. And when you break international law on a scale like this, there are real consequences. So I came to be more comfortable with the title American Nuremberg, which is about people in the U.S. government who are responsible for three different kinds of crimes, which I can talk about in a minute, in this thing that seems to be this never-ending war on terror.
Well, it was actually, what didn't Dick Cheney call it, enduring freedom?
Enduring freedom, right. Enduring freedom to have surveillance, enduring freedom to have your email and your internet activity and your phone calls monitored, enduring freedom to destroy nation after nation after nation. So, you know, let's count them up. There's Afghanistan to start with, which, by the way, did not attack us on September 11th, although there were people who were part of al-Qaeda, which was responsible for attacking us on September 11th, including the head of their organization, Osama bin Laden, who were resident in Afghanistan. There were actually offers to turn them over to the U.S. in return for certain things, but the U.S. preferred a military response. So, Afghanistan. Then there was Iraq. Then there was Libya. And now, although we didn't start the civil war in Syria, we are certainly helping it to continue. And we should not forget the country of Yemen, where the United States is currently involved in a war with our ally Saudi Arabia. And this is particularly ironic because in Yemen, we are essentially fighting on the same side as al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula against a group of tribal people called the Houthi, who happen to be Shia Muslims, as opposed to al-Qaeda and Saudi Arabia, where the vast majority of people are Sunni Muslims. So the U.S. has responded to one set of terrible attacks with wars in multiple countries on multiple continents. And I think that the people who are responsible for this, and of course for what we call extraordinary rendition, basically kidnapping people and sending them to other countries to be tortured, or kidnapping people and torturing them ourselves. I believe that these things are various kinds of really important crimes, and that those crimes, there needs to be justice for those crimes.
There has hardly been an anti-war movement protesting them, but before the war there was a significant movement, and the irony, of course, is the protest was exemplified by electing Barack Obama to the presidency and sweeping Democrats into the control of both the Senate and the House. But immediately Barack Obama said that instead of looking backward, we are going to look forward. And Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, also said essentially the same thing. And instead of having an investigation, even a minimum investigation like Britain did about its role getting into the Iraq War, nothing happened here. There was something that took place in a basement in Washington. But in terms of public demand for an accounting, it didn't happen.
No, that's absolutely right. And so the day that he came into office, President Obama signed executive orders that closed the CIA's black sites. This is what they call them. These were the secret torture centers that they had in Thailand and Poland, Romania, on the British island of Diego Garcia. They also had their own black site that was separate from the military, from the Defense Department in Guantanamo, in Guantanamo Bay. And he ordered those closed. And he also ordered that the use of what they called enhanced interrogation techniques, what ordinary people with an ordinary dictionary would call torture, that those should end. But you're exactly right. At the same time, he made this public announcement that we need to look forwards, not backwards. Now, my personal belief, and this is, I don't have a lot of evidence or any really to back this up, but I think that one thing that happened is that when he came into office, he also discovered the power of a permanent national security establishment, a national security state, and that there were limits to the power even of the President of the United States in facing that establishment, and that this was something of a quid pro quo, that yes, the CIA would agree to shut down these places and stop torturing people if they really did it, and, you know, we only have their word for it, but we can hope, and in return, there would be no prosecutions. And I think also, to be perfectly fair, that part of what he discovered was not only there are limits to the presidency, but those limits are much greater when the president happens to be a black man. Nonetheless, the result has been that nobody has been prosecuted, nobody has been held accountable in any public way for a series of different kinds of crimes. And in the book, I divide them into three sort of categories, kind of following what they did at Nuremberg. So the first one is war crimes, and that's something that the world was familiar with. There was already a big body of international law and custom about how wars should be conducted, what kinds of things violated that, including ways that prisoners couldn't be treated and so forth. But the other two categories were new. One of them is called crimes against humanity. And those are crimes that are committed in the context of a war, in the context of also committing war crimes, which involve the elimination, the destruction, or the mass deportation or movement of an entire group of people based on ethnicity, like the Jews, based on level of physical or mental ability, like disabled people, based on sexual orientation, like the LGBT people who were also killed by the Nazis, or the Roma people who were also killed by the Nazis. These were the crimes against humanity. But the United States and Britain argued very forcefully for the first crime, the crime that they said was the root of all the other crimes, and a lot of people don't remember this, which was the crime against peace. In other words, the idea that if you have international law against invading another country, and if you have, as Germany had and as the U.S. has, signed a treaty saying you will not invade another country unless you have been first attacked by that country, that crime against peace, that creating the initial war, was what the British and the Americans argued was the wellspring of all the other crimes. And we forget, we think, you know, Nazi Germany, the Holocaust, but most of the people who died in the Holocaust didn't die inside Germany. They died in occupied Poland. So it's the invasion of Austria, of Poland, of Czechoslovakia that begins all the rest of the crimes. You can't have war crimes without a war. And so as I was thinking about how the U.S. has behaved since September 11th, since those terrible attacks, one of the things that I realized is that we have been horrified, and properly so, and I wrote a whole book about it, by the torture that the U.S. has been involved in. And, you know, we had had a period since the end of the Vietnam War in which we more or less believed about ourselves that that's something we don't do. We may teach other countries how to do it at the School of the Americas, but we don't do it ourselves. And that, of course, all changed after September 11th. So we've really been focused on the torture, which is terrible. But we missed the bigger crime, and the crime that really, in the beginning, was responsible for the torture, and that's the invasion of Iraq. And the reason I say that is, when they first started torturing people, the very first people who were waterboarded, the very first people who were given the treatment that Donald Rumsfeld approved in Guantanamo that included sleep deprivation, stress positions, using dogs to terrify people, all of those kinds of things, those were all for the purpose of getting somebody somewhere to say that Saddam Hussein was in some way in cahoots with al-Qaeda and that Saddam Hussein, the then head of the Iraqi government, was responsible for September 11th. And of course, it wasn't true. But they took a man named Abu Zubaydah. They exposed him to what they call the waterboard. And, you know, waterboarding has been described in the media as simulated drowning. But there's nothing simulated about it. It's plain old drowning. And they did this to him 83 times. Well, you do that to anyone, and they'll tell you whatever it is you want to hear. And by the way, this Abu Zubaydah is a very interesting story. He's actually from Saudi Arabia. He is the person that every time somebody said, well, why do you have to do this torture? Why do you have to use these enhanced interrogation techniques? This was the man that Donald Rumsfeld turned to, that George W. Bush turned to, that Dick Cheney turned to, and said, see, this is why. So Donald Rumsfeld said he was the number two man, or very close to the number two man, in Al-Qaeda. George W. Bush said he was one of Osama bin Laden's top lieutenants. Later on, Bush also added, and Cheney went along with this, that he was running a training camp in Afghanistan where five of the original hijackers on September 11th were trained. So this was one of the really bad guys, as Bush used to like to say, and they had to torture him because he was so bad. Well, it turns out the main reason they were torturing him was to get him to say something about Saddam Hussein. But it also turns out that none of this was true. The prime example of why they had to torture, it was all lies. And in fact, it's true. He did run a training camp in Afghanistan because he was a CIA asset when the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan in the 1980s. He was training the Mujahideen, who were the Islamic fighters who were trying to throw out the Soviet Union occupation. He was one of Ronald Reagan's freedom fighters. And, of course, the Mujahideen eventually became the Taliban that the U.S. declared war on. And the Taliban ran Afghanistan in a horrible way, and it was particularly horrible for women. And I hold no brief for the Taliban, but they were actually the legitimate, at one time, U.S.-supported government of Afghanistan when we attacked them. So he had run this camp. The camp was called Khaldun. And here's how the CIA did the logical loop. Because he was running this camp, and he was known to be a lieutenant of Al-Qaeda, then Khaldun must be an Al-Qaeda training camp. Because he ran an Al-Qaeda training camp, he must be a high member of Al-Qaeda. So it was a complete logical circle that wasn't true. So the reason we know it's not true is that in 2009, now under the Obama administration, Abu Zubaydah's lawyers were presenting a case for what's called habeas corpus. That basically means, hey, government, you have this person's body. Tell us why you are holding him. So they have been suing the government for years to find out why he was being held in Guantanamo. Because once the CIA was done with him, they shipped him off to Guantanamo with a memo saying he should never again in his life have substantial or substantive contact with a human being, that he should be kept incommunicado for the rest of his life. So his lawyers are trying to find out, well, what did he do? So in the process, they're saying, well, you're claiming that he did this, you know, that he was an Al-Qaeda lieutenant, that he trained these people for 9/11, that maybe he knew something about the Millennium Bomb plot in 2000, that he helped Osama bin Laden escape from Afghanistan. You're claiming all of this. Show us the papers. Show us the proof. And so the government filed a brief in reply in which they said, we don't have to show you any papers because guess what? We're no longer claiming that he was in Al-Qaeda. We're no longer claiming that he was ever even a member of Al-Qaeda. We're no longer claiming that he ran an Al-Qaeda training camp. We're no longer claiming that he had anything to do with September 11th. So they withdrew every single reason why they're holding him, and yet the case drags on, and he is still in Guantanamo. So all of which is to say that the crime, the birth crime, if you will, was the desire to invade Iraq. And in fact, Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and his neoconservative cabal came into the White House with a plan to do exactly that. It's the same plan that they had tried to sell back in 1992 to Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, and it was called a clean break. And then they formed an organization, and there were about 20 of these people, including Khalilzad and Elliot Abrams, who some of you may remember from Central America days, and Paul Wolfowitz. And they
don't forget Richard Perle.
Right, absolutely, Richard Perle.
The Black Prince.
And they brought a whole bunch of these people. Dick Cheney brought them along with him into the White House. And they tried to sell the same plan to Bill Clinton in 1996 under the guise of an organization called the Project for a New American Century. And the plan was basically a plan to destabilize and then remake the Middle East along lines that would be more in keeping with U.S. strategic interests. So the first step was get rid of Saddam Hussein and open up the Iraqi oil fields to U.S. oil companies. Next was destabilize Syria, replace the Assad regime. In those days, it was Bashar Assad's father, but replace the Assad regime with somebody that we like better. Now, we liked Assad well enough to send him a Canadian named Maher Arar in 2003 to be tortured for 10 months. But nonetheless, we suddenly woke up one day and discovered that he runs a police state, which is true. And so we're definitely against Assad now. Destabilize Syria, and then eventually go on to Jordan. Libya was sort of on the side there. But the idea was that we would remake the whole Arab world along lines that were more, oh, and Iran, of course, that were so not just the Arab world, but the whole Middle East, along lines that would more appeal to U.S. interests. Well, I got to say, these guys were not only pernicious and determined, and they discussed these plans way back in March of 2001, long before September 11th, they were not only determined, but they were stupid. Because the end result is, yeah, they've remade the Middle East into chaos, but the U.S. oil companies didn't end up with most of the contracts in the Iraqi oil fields. So they didn't even get one of their, but not their only, prime objectives. So people don't remember, because September 11th came along and kind of wiped our memories. But way back in March of 2001, the big issue in the country was that Dick Cheney had been put in charge of creating the new energy policy for the United States. And this was the big job that George W. Bush gave him. And he was meeting with all these people. He was holding meetings, secret meetings, in the White House, and nobody could get him to say who he was meeting with to formulate our new energy policy. And in fact, he claimed executive privilege and said, I don't have to tell you who. And CEOs of oil companies went up on to Congress, to Capitol Hill, and perjured themselves and said they hadn't met with Dick Cheney when they had met with him 50 times. And what they were doing was laying out the plan to invade Iraq. And so on September 12th, 2001, the day after the attacks, we already see memos from Dick Cheney saying, is there any way we can pin this on Saddam Hussein? So they were already preparing this war that had nothing to do with September 11th, that had nothing to do with any kind of international law, that was in fact a violation of laws and treaties that the United States has signed. And by the way, in the U.S. Constitution, which some of us still fondly remember, in Article 6, it says, if we sign and the Senate ratifies a treaty, that treaty becomes part of the supreme law of the land. It's as if it were any other federal law. It has to be obeyed. That includes the Kellogg-Briand Treaty that we signed way back in 1928, saying we wouldn't attack people who didn't attack us. It also includes the Charter for the United Nations, of which the U.S. is, of course, a founding member and a permanent member on the Security Council. So it includes a lot of treaties. It also, of course, includes the Convention Against Torture, which we signed and ratified.
My guest, by the way, is Rebecca Gordon. This has been informative.
Let's talk about what we could do. War Crimes Tribunal.
Together, right.
So here's the problem. The right place for these people to be tried is either in U.S. courts or the International Criminal Court. But the U.S. is not part of the International Criminal Court. We love it when they try African leaders there. But under Bush, they actually withdrew the signature, and Congress passed a law making it illegal for anybody to assist the trying of any U.S. person in the International Criminal Court. So that's out. In fact, they even said that if somebody is on trial there, the army should go in and rescue them. Some people called it the Invade the Hague Law. So that's out. The chances that we're going to see prosecutions here in the United States, there are plenty of things they could do. The likelihood that Hillary Clinton or God knows Donald Trump is going to do that are very, very slim, in fact, nil. So in a way, that kind of throws it back on us. And I look back to the model that Jean-Paul Sartre and Bertrand Russell in Europe did in 1967 when they tried the United States government in a people's tribunal for war crimes in the Vietnam War. And these were held over a series of days in Europe. I think what we need is a people's tribunal. And I think we need to bring together people, ideally people of a variety of political stripes, but who believe in the rule of law, as I do, and people who have been victims of the war on terror in various ways, and to have a serious airing. Because the people I know who work with victims of torture and war especially, all of them say that the number one thing that people want in order to feel that they have had justice is for their story to be heard and publicly acknowledged. And so I think that if we can't get an official government acknowledgement, we need a people's acknowledgement of what has been done and sadly is still being done in our names as the people of this still nominally democratic country.
That was Rebecca Gordon, author of American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. The book was published by Skyhorse New York via its imprint, Hot Books. Rebecca Gordon teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco. Her prior book, Mainstreaming Torture, was based on her PhD thesis in ethics and social theory at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union, in Berkeley, California. Rebecca Gordon was interviewed by activist, photographer, and radio host Jeffrey Blankford on June 22, 2016. And my thanks go out to my friends Rebecca and Jeffrey and to KZYX Radio in Philo, California, for this extraordinary interview. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.